The following program comes to you as part of the Africa Health Network, a service of the Voice of America to our audience throughout the African continent.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Lenore Moudou, and welcome to Health Chat. Last week, the World Health Organization warned that new cases of Ebola could hit 10,000 a week by December. The WHO also said the fatality rate of the Ebola outbreak has now risen to 70%. Bruce Aylward, Assistant Director General of the World Health Organization, issued a dire warning saying the world is not doing enough to stop the spread of the Ebola outbreak. And where do we stand and what remains to be done to tackle the epidemic in West Africa? These are some of the questions that we will try to answer on the program today. Joining us in the studio is our guest, Dr. Chinua Akukwe. He's the U.S. National Academy for Public Administration and a professor at George Washington University. Dr. Akukwe, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lina. Thank you so much.
Also joining us via phone is psychiatrist and African immigrant health advocate, Dr. Akwa Asare. Dr. Asare, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
We'll discuss the Ebola epidemic in West Africa in a moment, but first, VOA's Carol Pearson has this report.
These doctors are suiting up to care for patients who have Ebola, one of the world's deadliest viruses. The humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders is helping local health care workers in Guinea treat Ebola patients. The fatality rate for this particular strain that has broken out there is up to 90%. People in the region are panicked. This man says most people have never heard of the Ebola virus before and are now very afraid. The virus has spread to the capital, Conakry, from forests in the south. The World Health Organization is concerned that Ebola has broken out in a region where it had never appeared before. But Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the Infectious Diseases Division at the National Institutes of Health, says Ebola's appearance in West Africa should not come as a surprise.
It's a disease that's spread by direct contact with an infected person, but it's also spread by exposure to an infected animal like a bat. And since we know those animals are in those areas of those adjacent countries, it's not that unusual to see outbreaks in areas in southern Africa that are adjacent to each other.
Fruit bats are the primary carriers of Ebola, although the virus doesn't kill the bats. Humans get the virus from infected bats or other animals that these bats come in contact with. Dr. Fauci says people need to avoid eating bushmeat and bats when there's an outbreak of Ebola. The symptoms are very much like those of the flu: fever, weakness, muscle pain, headache, and sore throat. But that's where the comparison ends. The next stage in Ebola is vomiting, diarrhea, and in some cases, internal and external bleeding. The flu is airborne. Ebola is not.
Ebola is almost invariably spread by direct contact with bodily fluids, particularly blood and secretions, vomit, things like that, of people who are deathly ill and people are taking care of them. So it's usually family members, physicians and healthcare providers, ministers who minister to the sick and to the dead, and to morticians who take care of the bodies.
The best way to control the virus is to get people with symptoms into isolation wards. Researchers are trying to find effective medications, but at the moment, the best chances of beating the disease are to drink plenty of fluids and get treated for secondary infections such as diarrhea. A number of patients in Guinea have recovered and have been discharged from treatment centers, but that doesn't mean they are completely free of Ebola. The WHO reports that men who have recovered from the disease can still transmit the virus to sex partners for up to 7 weeks after they recover. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
And Dr. Asare, Dr. Akukwe, again, thank you both for joining us today. Carol Pearson, in her report, gave us an overview of the disease, and this is really looking at the initial stages of the outbreak. Today, we're talking about over 4,500 deaths. Around 9,000 people are infected. Five countries are affected. Two have been able to contain the disease. Now, when you look at this picture, it's very, very, very troubling. Dr. Akuku, let me start with you. What can you tell us? What went wrong?
I think a number of things went wrong. The first thing is that the governments of the three affected countries did not react very quickly. And the second thing is that the public in those countries also did not believe their government when they raised the alarm that you had Ebola. And then the third thing is that the three affected countries are just coming out of conflict. So they still have to rebuild their infrastructure, and it takes years to rebuild. So you have a situation where their health systems are already compromised. And then the fourth thing is that Ebola, for the first time, invaded urban areas. It used to be at the edge of rainforests, whether it's in Central Africa and so on. But now it came into densely populated areas.
Very, very important points there. Now, there is one thing that was mentioned in the report that we don't really hear a lot about. The fact that, and Dr. Asare, men who have recovered from Ebola should abstain from sex because they can still transmit the disease up to 7 weeks. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. Actually, the most recent evidence, the most research on WHO and CDC not only says 7 weeks, it says up to 3 months.
Wow.
That the virus can be in the semen up to 3 months. So that's the latest that we got. It's even beyond 7 weeks.
But how does this affect women then? Is it the same with regards to women, or they don't know yet?
We don't know yet. We don't have the research right now on women, but it's safe to assume that it probably is also in the vaginal secretion in these fluids for quite some time as well.
Hmm. Now, Dr. Akukwe, when we look at the way there seems to be an international mobilization to tackle this epidemic, but yet WHO says enough is not being done. UNICEF says the same thing. MSF says the same thing. And all these groups, as well as others, are on the ground. So when we say enough is not done, and a group like WHO says that, when we know that everyone looks to the WHO to really address international health issues, who is not doing enough?
I think everybody. WHO, there's an internal document that was leaked a few days ago that WHO also was a little bit slow in responding. And then the international community, whether it's United States, UK, or even the multilateral agencies, they are just beginning to respond in the last 6 weeks. So I think a lot of people were taken unawares, because Ebola, since 1976, have always been contained within a small geographical area. So I think the acceleration of infection in urban areas took a lot of people by surprise. And you also have to understand that even ECOWAS and the African Union took some time in responding. So I think everybody will agree that the response was not as quick as you would expect.
So almost everyone is guilty.
Everybody definitely has some blame.
I have a comment here from Thomas in Liberia, actually, and he says that, well, he wrote a long email. Essentially, what he's saying is, the international community did not pay attention until an American became infected. That's his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
How do you react to that? Let me start with you, Dr. Asare, and then I'll come to you, Dr. Akukwe.
To be honest, I think that individual does have a point.
Hmm.
And the reason why I say that is because, as Dr. Kukwe mentioned before, the factors as to why this particular outbreak has been so powerful, we have to take into consideration that in many illnesses, in many cases, what is not in my face is not a priority. And so when an individual who is part of a citizenry of another culture becomes infected with a disease of this nature, then it comes to the limelight of that particular country. And I think many people thought Ebola was just something on the continent. It was a small thing. Oh, we've always had it. It's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But once an international individual was infected and affected, then I think people started noticing, because it wasn't simply an African illness.
So how do you feel about that, Dr. Akukwe?
Yeah, I think what Asare said is reasonably correct. But I think there are also a couple of issues. One is that the affected African countries did not raise alarm early enough.
Okay. Because, you know, some people were saying they did not want to have that stigma and, you know, so.
So it was a trade-off between, is this something that we can manage so that you don't damage tourism, damage development efforts,
exactly.
or do you raise the alarm until it overwhelmed everybody? Mm-hmm. But I think what Dr. Asare said is that until Dr. Ken Bradley and a couple of others got infected, it was rather difficult to get it into the subconscious of a typical American because they've had of Ebola and it was always contained.
It's a bit remote as
yes,
well.
Yes,
I think we also have to realize the fact that, you know, this is a perfect storm, as Dr. Kukwe mentioned. Mm-hmm. This is a situation of a perfect storm where all of these factors came into play and individuals in these countries were overwhelmed. There are some people who didn't even realize that it was Ebola until it was too late and by then it had spread.
Now, let's talk about, as we're looking at, not to play the blame game, but really to really understand what went wrong. Let's talk about the role that communities themselves play. We talked about cultural practices, cultural belief that really contributed to this whole outbreak. Dr. Akukwe.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. One is that, like I said initially, the community or the general public did not believe their government. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that there appears to have been some level of distance between governments of the three affected countries and the people they were ruling. So even when you raise alarm about Ebola, it was not easy to quickly close that gap. Then the third thing is that over the years, Liberia, Sierra Leone have had hemorrhagic fevers, whether it's Lassa fever, a little bit of Ebola and so on. So they would think that this is something that will die out. You know, it's not an issue that will quickly spread to the urban areas and kill a lot of people. And then the other thing is that the first group to raise alarm, the MSF, non-governmental organization, there are a lot of people that will say, well, they're always raising alarm. And, you know, so it was a question of, do we really believe them at this point in time or not? So until it became clear to both WHO and other experts that you had something very, very serious. So, but I think the issue of community participation, community mobilization is extremely critical in every protocol for containing infectious diseases, including Ebola.
Now we have Amina in Sierra Leone and she raises this issue. She says the people say not to touch other people when you see someone is falling sick, but essentially she's asking, what do you do when you see your child who comes down with a fever? He can have malaria. What do you do?
Well, that's part of the conundrum of public messages, but technically I think what the three countries have done and what Nigeria and Senegal did was to raise the high index of suspicion. If somebody comes down with fever and you think this is not the usual kinds of fever, take that person to the nearest hospital and make sure that you inform the healthcare professional. But there was a lag time in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone before either parents or relatives were able to do that. But in Nigeria and Senegal, if you read how they were able to contain, the moment the government raised the alarm, there was a high index of suspicion and relatives were bringing children or other relatives to the hospital and also warning the healthcare workers ahead of time that this could be a case of Ebola or somebody who had contact with another person who is suspected of having Ebola. So I think the high index of suspicion was not there in the three states, in the three countries until maybe sometime in late July or early August.
Perhaps a little bit of lack of experience as well, don't you think?
Yes, lack of experience, lack of anticipation of the extraordinary impact, both on the part of policymakers and of the average person in this three countries, and also on the part of the international community. You know, nobody anticipated that you would be having the kind of catastrophe that you have right now.
Indeed. Dr. Asare, let's talk about some of the steps that people can take in their homes, their communities to protect themselves. I know there are many, many messages that are being conveyed from governments, you know, and other groups about preventive steps. Can you walk us through a few of them? Let's say, for example, a family of five is in the home and then no one seems to be sick. But what can, in the case where no one seems to be sick, should they still take some steps in case something happened? And if yes, what are those steps? And in a case that someone is sick, can you walk us through this?
Sure. The first thing to do is to be aware of the situation, to be aware of the community, and to be aware of the cases that are surrounding you. If you happen to be in an area where Ebola is being frequently identified or diagnosed, then you have to make sure that you do not come into contact with the bodily fluids of anyone who has been diagnosed or anyone in the family that has also been diagnosed. You want to make sure that you keep away from soiled linens and materials. You want to also make sure that you keep your home as clean as possible, in the sense dealing with any sort of infectious processes that could be going on, making sure. In Nigeria, what they had is they just had hand sanitizer everywhere, mm-hmm. and they gave out hand sanitizer everywhere. So those are some of the steps to ensure, as well as being aware of any possible, like I said, infections that are going on in the community. When somebody does fall ill and you have, as Dr. Kukwe said, a high index of suspicion, the first thing you want to do is you want to notify the health officials as soon as possible, mm-hmm. so that they can come out and they can take the necessary precautions to take the individual to the hospital. Because the last thing you want to do is you want to cause contagion, not only to yourself, to the family, to anybody else, to a taxi driver, etc., etc. So notify local authorities first. Have them come, pick up the individuals, so they can take them to the hospital. And then you want to follow certain protocols. In the house, you can actually, Ebola, you can actually use hospital quality detergents and disinfectants, like household bleach. If you don't have anything, you can use household bleach. Ebola can be dried on doorknobs and countertops, and it can live up to several hours. Mm-hmm. Again, using the household bleach, making sure that you get rid of anything that was used by the individual who had a high index of suspicion of having the illness as well, and making sure that everybody keeps up their fluids, mm-hmm. because having fluids is important, it's vital, and making sure everyone is eating adequately. These sort of symptomatic treatments are very important.
Okay. Did you want to add anything, Dr. Akuku?
I think the only thing I'll add, in addition to notifying the authorities, that you have to keep abreast with whatever announcements that the government is mm-hmm. making.
Okay.
So if they are saying there is a new case in your county or your neighborhood, then you know that you definitely need to make yourself available to health authority if somebody comes down sick.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more of keeping up to date mm-hmm. with whatever mm-hmm. pronouncements from the government and print and electronic media in terms of incidence and prevalence of Ebola.
Okay. And also it's important, just very quickly, mm-hmm. one of the issues has been funerals.
Yes.
Well, it's been a very large issue, and the fact that there are very specific funeral rites that particular cultures in the area have always had as part of their cultural practices. And it's a problem, because individuals are very upset because they can't actually go by their cultural norms. And so if someone does pass away, it is important to also ensure that that person is buried quickly, and that the burial is done in accordance with the healthcare officials and the authorities, because there's a particular way that that person needs to be buried,
mm-hmm.
and all of their linens and all the clothing and everything else also has to be disposed of in a very particular way.
Okay. Now, we're seeing that some people here in the United States are calling to ban traveling from West Africa, and the WHO is saying that it's not really, they don't recommend it because supplies need to get there. People need to get there to help. What do you think about travel ban, Dr. Akuku?
Yeah, there is really no scientific evidence at this point in time. As you say, both WHO and CDC do not support banning from mm-hmm. those three countries. And I think also from an operational point of view, if you are rushing supplies to three deeply impacted countries, if you ban contact, how would they get in those supplies?
Mm-hmm.
And how would you know what is going on from an epidemiological point of view, from a disease management point of view? You are cutting yourself off from an infection that has already gotten into densely populated areas. And we know that even if you ban flights, people still travel. So what
yes.
you are definitely going to encourage is illegal travel.
Mm.
From some of these countries. So at this point in time, but I think what the U.S. and other European countries are doing, and also the African countries are doing, is very important. The issue of screening at the ports, sea and airport. You make sure you screen everybody, and if there is anybody with high temperature, they are not allowed to travel, and they are further evaluated clinically to see if they have so in Ebola or not. So that should be stepped up in all ports and sea and airports around the world as part of global containment, not banning travel.
It's a good first step, definitely. Yes. Mm-hmm. But we've seen in the case of Eric Duncan, unfortunately, who passed away, that he went through all the process, but still he had the virus, which developed itself after he came here. So then, Dr. Asare, let's talk about treatment protocol. We see here that Kent Brantley, who survived the disease, has been given out his blood, you know, through blood transfusion, and experts say that it's able to boost immunity for those who are infected. What can you tell us a little bit about what is being done in terms of treatment, and then Dr. Akuku, I'll get your take on this as well. Is blood transfusion part of the whole process? Dr. Asare, let me start with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. When you're looking at treatment for Ebola, what really is absolutely essential is close supervision of the individuals who have it. The symptomatic treatment, and when we say symptomatic treatment, sometimes people don't understand exactly what that means. Symptomatic treatment basically means that you treat the symptoms. So if somebody has fever, you want to bring down the fever with medications called antipyretics. If they're experiencing pain, you want to make sure you give them the pain medication. You absolutely are doing, they're checking their vitals, their blood pressure, their pulse, their temperature every 30 minutes, every 15 to 30 minutes. You want to make sure you address the vomiting, make sure they have fluids, make sure they have electrolytes. So this is part of the symptomatic treatment that doctors who are dealing with this on a daily basis are saying is really the crux of the treatment for this particular illness. When it comes to things like transfusions, you have to take into consideration that what Dr. Brantley has been doing is he has been providing his plasma, because the antibodies which bind, or special proteins that bind to the virus that prevent the virus from multiplying, are found in the plasma.
So what's the difference with the, isn't it through blood transfusion that they get the plasma? Mm-hmm. Is there a difference there?
There is a difference.
Okay, please.
There is a difference. There's a difference between giving whole blood, which has the plasma, and other parts of the blood, and just the straight plasma itself, which is part of the blood.
Okay.
There's a specific medical way where what they do is they take out the blood, they spin off the plasma, and then they return the rest of the blood to the individual who is donating. Hmm. So only the plasma is taken out. And that can only be done 13 times a year. That's about every 28 days that we recommend that you do plasma transfusions, because it takes about that much time for the body to replenish itself when it comes to those transfusions.
So is this something that is being done in the treatment protocol in West Africa, Dr. Akuku? Do you know of it? I mean, Dr. Asare, did you want to answer?
Yes, actually I did. I don't know, people don't even know that Dr. Brantley was given one unit from a patient in Liberia, a 14-year-old patient.
Hmm.
So he was given one unit prior to leaving Liberia.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's being done.
It's being done. But I think there are three important messages that everybody needs to understand. Today, there is no medical cure for Ebola.
Mm-hmm.
The WHO, CDC, and then as Dr. Asare said, the gold standard for care is supportive clinical care. Whether you are in Dallas or whether you are in Monrovia, whether you are in Lagos, if you provide supportive clinical care and treat the symptoms, then you give that individual the opportunity to survive. So wherever you have health systems that cannot support or provide that supportive round-the-clock care, that's how a lot of people die.
Health system has a lot to do. Because it seems like it's almost like a 24-hour type of observation and care. I mean, for one person, that's a lot when you look at
absolutely.
Yeah, that's a lot. And then you have to talk about waste disposal. I think Dr. mentioned about it. And you also talk about food, nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about potable water, mm-hmm. access to basic sanitation. And you had also mentioned the issue of burial teams.
Yes.
So these are the things that have to be in place.
Yes.
So that if somebody is receiving care, and then protective clothing for the health workers.
Absolutely.
So that they can better care for that individual. Mm-hmm. We've learned now from what happened in Dallas that except if you're not very careful about your protective care, people will get infected.
Yes.
Yes. And that will deter a lot of healthcare workers from providing 24-hour care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now, when we talk about health system, I totally agree that a weak health system is really, it's challenging for mm-hmm. a weak health system to handle such a very virulent crisis outbreak. But my question is always, whatever happened when the outbreak started in Zaire in 1976, which mm-hmm. is now the DRC, the health system was not that strong. It was very weak. And even recently, there was another outbreak, which they contained very quickly. So when we look at health system, yes, I understand, but I'm still a little bit confused with this. What is working with DRC that is not working in West Africa?
Yeah, it's two simple things. One is that DRC, it continues to be infection around the edge of the rainforest, not in densely populated areas.
Okay.
Uganda some few years ago had one or two cases in Kampala that was quickly contained, just like Nigeria did. So, but in these three countries, you are looking at densely populated capital cities and the second cities that are infected.
Okay.
Then secondly, and I think I've said it a number of times, post-conflict countries have special challenge of infrastructure.
Okay.
And I think that what can come out of this, the legacy of Ebola, is that perhaps the international community and Africa will now look into how to rebuild health systems in Africa, especially within the poorest countries. And then for some countries that can never have the capacity to have a fully functional health system, perhaps a regional approach to health system. For instance, if ECOWAS had a robust healthcare program or so on and so forth,
mm-hmm.
they could have easily rushed assistance to mm-hmm. Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone that in the next 10 years
mm-hmm.
may never have that capacity to take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the silver lining in the Ebola outbreak is that within the next few years, I expect the international community and African governments and institutions to radically look at how to revamp health systems in Africa.
Let me ask you this question, Dr. Asare. This is from Kofi in Ghana. He says, given the way things are escalating, will West Africa survive this Ebola outbreak? It seems to be a very general question, but I guess I will narrow down to say, how will we survive this? Moving forward, what do we need, Dr. Asare?
The number one thing that we need is to ensure that we put resources into our public health systems. Because as Dr. Kukwe also mentioned, in Nigeria, they were able to handle this quickly, concisely, because they had a public health system that was ready and vigilant. We have to understand that our public health systems must be developed, the infrastructures must be developed so that we deal with issues of sewage, so that we deal with issues of sanitation, that we have potable water, that we have medications, that we have gowns, that we're not reusing needles if we don't have to, that we have hospital systems that can handle that, and also, in addition, that we have the public health education systems, community healthcare workers and nurses and physicians and other individuals, even if it's a chief, even anybody, people who are involved in the process who are educating us about what is going on. So it's a twofold plan. One, make sure the community is involved.
Mm-hmm.
Two, make sure the governmental public health systems are involved and have the capacity and the resources. A lot of individuals, both here and abroad, are sending things back home to their relatives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is great. They're sending gloves and they're sending IV fluids and all of this. But who's going to be the one to deliver and dispense this?
Who's going to deliver? And that will be the last word. We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Dr. Asare, thank you so much for joining us via phone.
Thank you.
Dr. Akukwe, thank you for being here in the studio with us.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in and listening to Health Chat on The Voice of America. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu, in Washington, with producer Jackson Mvunganyi. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.